Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Eat, Sleep, Cheer, Repeat, the inspiring new documentary about the Irish cheerleading team. With Bodkin being number one in the Netflix charts, we talk to its creator and producer, Jez Scarfe and Alex Metcalf. Plus, we review If, the movie about imaginary friends who never went away. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. It's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. I was in France last week, even though there was a show, got it all together, but I was in France with the family, sunning myself. It was absolutely delightful. You forget that there are places in the world where the sun shines all day long and it's hot. You know, you haven't done it in a year or maybe 2 years or whatever. You kind of forget that feeling. And then you're sitting under the sun going, God, I forgot. We have sunshine occasionally. So it was delightful. And I want to say I have no allegiance, loyalties whatsoever to any airline. In our party, our five-year-old, a very nervous, apprehensive, agitated, distressed flyer, and the national carrier, Aer Lingus, could not have been nicer. Offering him drinks, moved his seat, absolutely delightful. And I just want to say that to one air hostess in particular, and I didn't get her name, and we should have, because she was absolutely wonderful. I just want to say that. And I'm curry no favour. But it's important to call these things out when they happen to you. And similarly, the man sitting in front of us who complained several times about the aforementioned distressed child kicking his chair. I won't repeat what I said to you, but I meant every word what I said to you. Talking of assholes, this week in TV, I was watching this.
Let me ask you something, Harry. You ever been hunting? Ever headed out in the pickup early in the morning, listen to all those boys talking about all the birds they're gonna shoot? People, they shoot a lot of birds in their mouths on the way out the fields, but there comes a time when you finally gotta stop the truck, pick up a gun, and do something with it. Down where I grew up, Baker County, there's a saying, the tailgate drops, the bullshit stops. Well, now the tailgate's done dropped. We are here with a goddamn serious business plan and a proposal for restructuring these loans. What we are not here for is a lecture about the nature of debt management. I'm not sure who the hell you think you're talking to.
Now that is a clip of Jeff Daniels in a show that landed on Netflix a couple of weeks ago called A Man in Full. It's based on a Tom Wolfe novel of the same name. And in it, we have Jeff Daniels playing Charlie Croker, who is a famous football player who's now a kind of business mogul and has created this massive tower, you know, business tower, similar to a very large tower in New York that's in the real world. And indeed, the similarities don't end there, because it feels very much like the Jeff Daniels character, Charlie Croker, is aping a very famous real estate mogul who now may be running for election in the United States. And Jeff Daniels, though, it differs in that Jeff Daniels is kind of from Atlanta, and he's rural and talks in kind of a country twang. And as I say, he was a famous football player. It begins with him at his 60th birthday. It's all very lavish. And then the bank that have been, you know, giving him money all these years come to collect, basically. And he thinks they're just going to refinance, but they don't. And the SH1T hits the fan big time. And this gets very political as well, because there's a political dimension to it and how he may or may not get out of the debt. There is a brilliant supporting cast in this. And it is 6 episodes, and Jeff Daniels is absolutely brilliant in it. I thought it was going to be him playing a version of Trump or something like that, but it's a lot more than that. I don't know if it is based on Trump, but it is Jeff Daniels in Emmy-winning performance mode, I would have to say, because he's a bit of a unpleasant man. But as the show goes on, there are endearing shades to him. And what he will do to try and survive is brilliant. And we can't get into it all, but there's all these other stories going on with his ex-wife, played brilliantly by Diane Lane, and a guy from the bank who wants to bring him down. There's a whole mayoral thing about the next mayor being elected. You know, it's not like The Wire because it's too light for that, but there's a lot going on in this city of Atlanta, all coming through Jeff Daniels. I loved it. Six episodes, watched them pretty rapidly in succession. And what I loved about it was that thing of, I really didn't know where this was going and what kind of show it was. It was really entertaining, really, really entertaining. So a big thumbs up for A Man in Full, now streaming on Netflix. Do let me know if you might have watched it or anything else at all. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. And we turn to the week's new big cinema releases. Chief among them is If, directed by John Krasinski of The Office fame, all about imaginary friends, and a very unusual and indeed intriguing movie, I think I haven't seen it, called Hoard, a kind of psychological drama about hoarding, if I'm understanding that correctly. To shed light on this is our regular reviewer, Chris Wasser, arts journalist and film critic. Hello, Chris, how are you?
John, I'm very well. How are you?
Very well. So look, you know, If is about imaginary friends. I've seen the trailer and stuff. It seems like a lovely idea. The idea that you would, you know, bring back imaginary friends that children no longer see. That's kind of the plot, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the plot. Yeah, John, it's a gorgeous idea. And John Krasinski says that he first came up with this in and around the time of the pandemic, when he was watching his children playing at home, and he was watching his daughters, you know, imagining, you know, as you say, these otherworldly friends. And I think at one point he said that, you know, there was a talking tree in the corner, and one of his daughters said, "Can't you see it?" And he said, "No, I can't." And then the other daughter was asking all of these questions about the real world. And he thought, that's an interesting kind of idea there, that, you know, one kid is kind of, you know, has the imaginary friends. And the other, because of what everything that was going on in the world at the time, is asking these very serious questions. So he started to develop this story about what exactly happens, that sort of bridge between childhood and, you know, your teenage years, when you let go of all of those, you know, magical creations, whether they be imaginary pals or magical landscapes that you and your friends or your siblings used to create. What happens to all of that? And he imagined this fantasy where all of these imaginary friends, all of a sudden, they're invisible again. They've always been invisible, but they're invisible to the one person who would have seen them. And where did those guys go? And can they get new jobs? You know, that there's this wonderful concept in the film where you have all of these lonely imaginary friends auditioning for new, you know, child pals in New York City. And I must admit, that is a gorgeous idea.
It sounds beautiful and really human, you know?
Yeah, and it's a great jumping off point for a wonderful fantasy comedy. Does it work? Not quite. Now, there is a bit of a story there. It's often a confusing story, but it actually, as I said, it kind of takes place mostly in New York City. And we're introduced to this young family via this jumpy home video recording at the beginning. The closest thing, another film that kind of came to mind when this montage was playing out was Up. You know, that idea of two people meeting and falling in love, and there's a lovely family there, but you know something tragic is around the corner. And in this case, you have a mother, a father, and a young girl named B. And the mother has died of cancer. And the father then is preparing for some, you know, rather serious heart surgery. So the little girl, who's now 12 years of age, played by Kayleigh Fleming, she's sent to live with her grandmother, played by Fiona Shaw, for a summer. And her dad's in hospital. And, you know, he's kind of this beacon of positivity. And he says, look, this is not the same as mom. I'm going to get better. I'm going to be home in no time. In the meantime, go out there, live your life, come back with a wonderful story to tell, have fun in New York City, which is weird advice for a little kid in New York City, but but she does that anyway. And in doing so, she encounters this very strange neighbor upstairs in her grandmother's apartment. She thinks that she's being followed around by a little girl, and she can hear this this male voice talking to the little girl. It's actually not a little girl. Upstairs is a chap named Cal, played by Ryan Reynolds, and his roommates. One of them is a purple furry creature called Blue, not purple, Blue. He's voiced by Steve Carell. And what she thought was a little child is in fact a humanoid cartoon butterfly named Blossom, voiced by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And who are these people? Well, Cal tells her that they're imaginary friends that have been abandoned. And for some reason, He can see them, and she can see them too. And he says that it's his job to help them and other imaginary friends that are scattered around New York City. A lot of them, for some reason, John, live on Coney Island. It's their job, it's Cal's job, to basically try and get their grown-up friends, you know, the grown-ups that used to hang around with these ifs, try and get them to remember them so they can see again. And if that fails, try and get them new pals. So B has the whole summer in New York City. She decides to help out Cal.
And again, lovely kind of plot, it seems to me, or lovely idea for a plot. But I'm sensing this doesn't come together then.
It really doesn't. And it's just a mystery to me that something that sounds so bonkers but so delightful just never really takes off. And I was all in on this, John, because I'm a fan of John Krasinski, his work on
and
The Office.
He plays the dad, doesn't he, as well?
He plays the dad, yeah. And we see him briefly. I mean, most of the stuff that he was doing here, it's a little bit like his role, although he did have a larger role in A Quiet Place. But his job in that film was to manage the whole thing. You know, he was a writer, director, producer. It's the same job here. You know, he's in charge of everything, but he decided to put himself into it too. So I was going in with all the goodwill. I thought, you know, I loved the A Quiet Place films. You know, I think he's a very good storyteller. I just thought, I'll wait for this to shine. I'll wait for this to dazzle. I was waiting nearly 2 hours and it just didn't. I mean, I can see what he's trying to do here. It kind of, there are times when it kind of walks and talks like a live action Pixar film. And, you know, you can, as I said, you can spot shades of Up in that opening montage.
Yeah.
You get the same ideas as you had in Toy Story, this idea of, you know, well, if the kids stop playing with me, what's my purpose in life? You know, all that kind of stuff. And there are, and the concepts and some of the story, it leans dangerously close to what we were seeing in Monsters, Inc. And also for older film fans, you will spot a very neat reference to Henry Koster's Harvey, which is a fabulous comedy from 1950. You know, you had Jimmy Stewart going around the place saying that, you know, his best friend was an invisible rabbit and no one believed him. So Krasinski knows what he's doing here, or at least you think that. You know, he is wearing his influences on his sleeves. It just never has the same drive or wit or ingenuity of those influences. And instead, it's kind of this story that sets up its stall and then goes absolutely nowhere. It doesn't commit to the family element. It really doesn't commit to the idea that New York City is, you know, overflowing with these weird, lonely, otherworldly creations. It doesn't really explain anything very well. I mean, and the first sign of problems, I thought, John, was in that opening montage, because when those home video recordings finished, I was, and this is a children's film, remember, I was sitting there going, Did somebody die in that montage? And where's the dad now? So is the mom dead? And if you're pausing to ask yourself questions like that, then something has gone wrong with the storytelling.
Because in Up, because I remember being in a cinema and I wasn't the only one openly weeping because it was very apparent what had happened in that opening montage.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, and tell me this, like, because the big imaginary friend Blue is voiced by Steve Carell. I mean, Steve Carell just has that glorious voice that I was going to say children love, but adults do as well when he's doing that. Is that successful, seeing as he's the main imaginary friend?
He does better than anybody else because he knows that there's a difference between being hired to lend your voice to a film because of your profile and your name and being hired as a voice actor, because those are two very different roles. And it seems John Krasinski has just rounded up all of his famous friends and family members here. I mean, he's got Blake Lively, you know, the actress who's also married to Ryan Reynolds. He's got George Clooney, Matt Damon. He's got his wife, an actress, Emily Blunt. Everybody is in there and they're all just basically, they all sound like themselves. Steve Carell puts on a proper performance. And it is very good and it's enthusiastic and it's lively and it's exactly what this sort of film needs. But you're only as good as your lines. And there are no funny gags in this film. The jokes just fall so flat. It's so strange that Krasinski spent so long on a comedy like The US Office and didn't come away, you know, with sort of a knowledge or a skill in putting together an effective punchline. So that element is disappointing. I thought the effects too and some of the sequences were quite bland. I found it both uncoordinated and a little, and as I said, it's hard to follow sometimes. It's like, what exactly are they doing here? Because they sort of abandoned the whole auditioning imaginary friends for new kids And then they focus just on one person, and then they focus on the grandmother. Then they come back to the dad. It was a little bit unsure what's going on here. And there's no real obstacles. There's no real lessons to learn. There's no real moral at the end of the story. It's very straight. It's very half-hearted. And there's also a sense that was this cut, you know, during like post-production, like did John Krasinski have a sense that this is too muddled? This is a bit all over the place. So it is unfortunately bland, uncoordinated. I had so many questions about the internal logic, John. I really did.
Yeah.
I was also worried about a 12-year-old like wandering around New York City with the weird neighbor from upstairs. And that actually finally brings me to Ryan Reynolds. He's in PG form here, you know, so we're not getting, you know, Mr. Deadpool. But that sarky, self-aware shtick, that has run its course. He just annoyed me in this, unfortunately.
Okay, time is up. So listen, you give reviews to things and sometimes they're not great, but, you know, it's what we do. So I'm disappointed to hear that. I was looking forward to bringing my 8-year-old to it. But look, c'est la vie, that's why we pay you the big bucks to tell us the truth. So what are you going to say stars-wise for If?
I think... Look, it's armed with all the goodwill in the world, and I really wanted to like it, but I was just so disappointed. I mean, I do think, you know, if you look really, really hard, you might find that there's a good project in there somewhere. And I think it really could have been something special, but I think we're just going to have to imagine what that might have looked like because we didn't get it. So 2 stars.
2 stars. Oh, it actually sounds like it's a terrible thing to say considering I haven't seen it, but it sounds like it should be remade. And I get no pleasure saying that because it's such a gorgeous idea. And I'm a big fan of John Krasinski. And I couldn't get over the fact that he was the Quiet Place guy, having been this great character in The Office. But anyway, 2 stars, unfortunately, for If. Let's take a quick clip.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, lots more. I mean, almost every kid has one. Had one.
Had what?
A friend.
An imaginary friend?
If. We say if.
Get it? Imaginary? Friend? But also like, what if? Like, anything's possible!
Ooh, out.
That was a clip of If, which is in cinemas, not, it isn't a cinema, it is in cinemas from this Friday, the 17th of May, and Chris is giving it 2 stars. We both wanted to like it more, but at least Chris went to see it. It's more than I did, but I will. Even though it's not getting a good review, I did promise my daughter I would take her to it. So I will report with Chris again on what I thought of it, but we're often in line on these things. Now, another movie out this week, you couldn't get more different, or could you? That made no sense, but you know what I mean. Horde, a psychological British drama about, I suppose, childhood trauma centered around hoarding.
Yeah, it's a very different film to If. That's for sure. Look, great cast here and a great story too. It all revolves around this family. Well, we check in on this young girl, Maria, first in the 1980s and then 10 years later in the 1990s. And she has 2 different mothers during this time. So first of all, in the 1980s in Southeast London, we have her mother played by the great Hayley Squires, who broke out from I, Daniel Blake a few years back. Mm. And she's in trouble. Basically, John, she can't go a day without filling their home with the rubbish. And she's just this serial hoarder. It's a debilitating obsessive compulsive disorder. She essentially spends her days. She does have a job, but when she gets home, she brings young Maria, her 7-year-old daughter, played by Lily Bo Leach here. She brings her out at night and they basically go, you know, all around Southeast London, you know, going through bins and bringing home waste. And, you know, it could be food. It could be sometimes, you know, dead animals. Sometimes it could be, you know, discarded children's toys, whatever. And she is filling up their home with this, so much so that when Maria comes home from school, where she's being bullied, because I think some of the other kids begin to suspect that all is not right at home, she can barely get in the door. So the house is this disaster zone. And it's only, you know, you can see where this is going, that it's only after a nasty tumble that Cynthia suffers at home that the authorities are forced to intervene, that, you know, the police come into the house and they see, wow, this is not good. So they send little Maria off to live with this kind-hearted foster mother, played brilliantly by Samantha Spiro. And it's here that she comes of age, and it's a lovely little trick where the two Marias, the first actress, Lily Bo Leach, and the second one, Sora Lightfoot Leon, they pass one another in the hallway of this house. And it's a jump, basically, from 1984 to 1994. And in that time, we see that, you know, she had... you know, not to say that Cynthia wasn't a caring mother in her own way, but Michelle gives her a, you know, quote unquote, normal life. And there is this sign that, you know, when she finishes school, she might be able to kind of make something of herself. But unfortunately, her graduation coincides with the arrival of Michelle's old foster kid, Michael, played by Joseph Quinn from Stranger Things. And he has problems of his own. And they kind of come back up to the surface when he meets Maria, because he can see what she's hiding. He can see that hidden darkness in her. So the two of them come together, and it's not good for either of them.
Yeah. And I, as I mentioned in it, you know, obviously the hoarding from her childhood that she witnessed, that comes home to roost in a certain fashion, I'm sensing. So I kind of know what you thought about this, because we were talking beforehand. And, you know, there are other publications that you and I would both rate, and people are wildly differing on this. Like, some people think this is, you know, a daring piece of cinema, and other people are just saying it's kind of needlessly grim and isn't that impressive. Where are you on it?
I've read some 4 and 5 star reviews of this, actually, and then some reviews this week have started to say, look, it kind of, you know, it is a little bit messy. I'm with those latter reviews. I do think that when Hayley Squires is in it, it's a fine film, and it's brilliantly acted, and it kind of leans into the psychological social drama side of things, you know, and it's a very authentic, very gritty, grubby, scuzzy tale, but it's authentically performed and realistic. I think once Squires leaves it, and although there is that lovely segment in the middle where Maria is transitioning to Michelle's home, once actually Michael comes into it and Squires is gone, that's Joseph Quinn's character, it all just collapses into this absurd melodrama. And there are elements of theatricality involved where it's sort of the realism is abandoned in favor of something kind of stagey and over theatrical. And it just jumps around the place. Characters begin to do things that are kind of not in line with what we were seeing them do 5 or 10 minutes ago. And I just thought, a lot like the house that we see Maria living in at the beginning, it all just is a bit too untidy. There's too much of everything in here. You know, there are some lovely ideas, and this is a very ambitious work from a debut feature filmmaker, Luna Carmoon, who up until this point has directed shorts. There are some wonderful ideas in here, and there is a strong story there at the beginning, but I just think it loses its way. It stops making sense, actually, around the halfway mark. That all said, and I should say too, it made me feel unwell at times, but that's you know, that's the point. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you weren't feeling unwell watching this, then something's wrong. Something's very wrong.
And not to be pretentious or meta about it, but and maybe this isn't why we go to movies, but the untidiness of the second half, is that not meant to be her psychodynamics writ large? So we're seeing a movie that mirrors how untidy her life was as a child. But I guess that's not true. That entertaining, maybe.
Yeah, I think there might be a way to do that effectively while also, you know, telling a story properly. Mm-hmm. And I just think the storytelling suffers. Definitely, I do think that might have been an intention. But there are just times where I was kind of confused as to, you know, just the dynamics of Michael and Maria's relationship, because you have this point in the film where these troubled, tortured souls, they just start to bring out the absolute worst in one another. It's just a toxic, troubling relationship. And it's fun to watch that relationship at times, but then there are points where they kind of literally start to dance around one another, and it all turns into this interpretive thing that might have worked a little bit better on a stage. So it just started to lose me, basically. But I will say, great performances. It's always a pleasure to see Hayley Squires. Again, the film kind of slips a little bit after she leaves. Joseph Quinn, who I don't think will be making many more films like this for a while. And that's actually a bad thing. What I mean, I'd like to actually see Joseph Quinn in smaller independent features, but we know that he's in the next A Quiet Place film coming this summer. Mm-hmm. We know he signed up to Fantastic Four. He commits himself here. He is terrific. And so too is Samantha Spiro, as I said, the foster mother. And then the two Marias, especially Sora Lightfoot Leon, who is in most of the film as a teenage Maria. There's not a single performer here who doesn't, you know, show up, who doesn't deliver the goods. I just think the story around them is just too messy.
Yeah, well, look, it's either good or it isn't, whatever artistic ambitions it might have or points it's making. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Horde, which is also in cinemas from this Friday?
I think it's 2 negative reviews this week, John. I think we're going to have to go for 2.5 stars for Horde.
Okay. Not a good week, but a pleasure to talk to you. That is 2 stars for If and 2.5 for Horde. I've been talking to our regular reviewer, arts journalist and film critic, Chris Wasser. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Up next, the creators of Bodkin on its number one place in the Netflix charts. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, 2 weeks ago, we covered the Netflix series Bodkin, all about a gang of wily, and I suppose not so wily, podcasters who set out to investigate the mysterious disappearance of three strangers in an idyllic coastal Irish town. But once they start pulling at threads, they discover a story much bigger and weirder than they could have ever imagined. I spoke to Will Forte, the podcast host, Siobhan Cullen, who plays Dove, a journalist with her own problems, who reluctantly agrees to join the podcast team at the order of her newspaper and comes back to Ireland, where she really doesn't want to be. And also Robin Cara, who plays Emmy, the much put upon researcher, who I very much empathized with, having been a researcher on this radio station for a long time. Anyway, why are we returning to it? Well, as of this morning, it was the number one show on Netflix in Ireland, overtaking the much talked about Baby Reindeer, and it's number five globally, and awards have already started with a nomination for the Gotham Awards. I'm delighted to be joined now by the show's creator, Jez Scharf, and the show's executive producer and co-showrunner, Alex Metcalf. Guys, you're all very welcome to the show. And Jez, if I can start with you, I was thinking in terms of motivation when I watched it. And as I said to you beforehand, I watched all seven episodes. True crime podcasts, there's a sense of, you listen to them and you go, gosh, this is very entertaining. And then maybe you stand back and you go, hang on a second, someone or many people died here. Was that part of your motivation to look at the motivation for people making podcasts?
To some extent, yes. Part of my process of writing is really, this is going to sound kind of odd, but is to work out what I think. And I was listening to a lot of true crime podcasts, and that was definitely a part of it, of how much of a person's personal tragedy should we be consuming it as entertainment. And I think in ep one of the show, you know, Dove describes true crime as a bit like a public hanging. Like, is it good and useful for us to be consuming, or does it speak to some, you know, kind of bloodlust within the human heart? But actually, as we, you know, once Alex came on board and we really were kind of like getting into the heart of what the show is and what we wanted to say, I think a more profound, well, I say profound, sorry, I sound like I'm self-aggrandizing there, but what we were really interested in getting at is actually the nature of truth and story and how we construct ourselves and our world around us through story. And actually, I guess the question that we were really interested by, because I think there's a lot of discussion right now about the morality of true crime, but really in the show, what we're trying to get at is how we construct ourselves and how we construct our world with story. And what is the virtue of telling violent stories, and does the telling of violent stories make our world more violent and do some damage to ourselves in some way? Sorry, that sounded very intellectual. It's 7 a.m. here. I'm very sorry.
And I should mention, I'm talking to you on both coasts of America at the moment, from San Francisco and indeed New York. And Alex, we go to New York now. One of the things I really like about it is the cast are all on superb form. And I mentioned the three people I spoke to, and it's no surprise there because they're brilliant. Chris Whalley's great. But the person, and I'm not surprised, I suppose, but because I've seen him in lots of Irish things over the years, but the character of Seamus, played by David Wilmot, I just thought he was brilliant, because he begins maybe, and I don't want to give any kind of spoiler, but is maybe just, for want of a better phrase, you know, a good, hard-working country bumpkin, right? And I don't mean that as pejorative as it sounds. And then we strip away the layers and there's a lot going on, and it takes a certain kind of actor to play that. So do you share my approbation of David Wilmot? I presume you do. I just thought he was brilliant.
I think David Wilmot's brilliant. I mean, you give him the phone book and you will sit there and be entranced by whatever he's saying. You know, we were so lucky to get David. I really believe that. And you know, for the character of Seamus, which, as you say, kind of, you know, there's this huge arc that he's got over the course of the series. And it requires, you know, somebody who's really good. And David is just sublime. You know, yeah. I wish he were famous. Though that said, if he were famous, we couldn't have got him. So I'm happy he's not quite as famous as he should be. But yeah, we were very lucky to get David, and he, you know, the plot revolves around him, really, and it's such an important character, and he just, you know, plays it with such verve and such passion. You know, we couldn't have asked for anybody better, and now, of course, we can't see that role with anybody but David's face in it.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Well, look, his hiding his life under a bushel may be about to end if these figures keep going the way they are. Lots of people may want him. So his secret may be out of the bag, but let's see what happens. And Jez, just when I spoke to Will Forte, one of the other things I like about it is, and I put it to him, and I'm not, maybe he misunderstood me, although he's a smart man, so I doubt it. But I said his character is the kind of Irish American or American Irish people love to hate, and that he comes over as Gilbert and it's like Ireland is lovely, it's the land of mystery and all that kind of stuff, and we as cynical Irish people go, oh, give it a rest, not the top of the morning stuff. but his characterization grows. Like, is that the kind of guy you wanted? You wanted the kind of typical American at the start, because he becomes something much else. American tourist, well, I mean.
Well, I think part of the theme of the show is that we start all the characters and in fact, all the elements, the story beginning kind of broad places. And as we dig into them, we discover the specificity. And I think part of constructing Gilbert in that way was about, he has a story in his head of what Ireland is.
Yeah.
And he wants to come to Ireland and experience that story. When he gets to Ireland, he finds that it's much more specific and weirder and darker and more brilliant than he ever expected. It's a real place.
You know? Yeah.
And that said, though, I do want to say we definitely wanted to play with the expectation of the American tourist, because there's such you know, it's such a trope of like, oh, my grandfather's Irish, my great-grandfather's Irish, I'm Irish. Don't you understand? And it's so ludicrous and fun to play with that we couldn't help it.
It is very funny. And he enjoys his full Irish every morning, which I particularly like. But for people who haven't watched it, and apparently it's not that many, because as I keep saying, it's number one in the charts at the moment. But he goes lots of different places, and he may begin as kind of that typical American, but there's a lot more going on to him. And look, we mentioned the Irishness. Now, and the popularity of the show so far. So I want to mention Paddy Wackery, right? Because I was worried that there might be some Paddy Wackery in this. And the reviews have been largely very positive for this. I've seen 4 stars. Mm. It's been, you know, it's been rightly lauded by some people who don't normally laud this kind of stuff. But there have been 1 or 2 ones that have suggested Paddy Wackery and taken shots at it. Now, you're big boys. And again, either of you can answer this. But I wonder, you know, Jez, I know in your case, you've been working on this for 6 years. It must sting a little when you know, people don't necessarily see it the way you do, or I see it, or indeed my wife.
Sorry, Jez, can I jump in?
Okay? Oh, you absolutely may, yes.
Those specific reviews that accusing us of Paddy Wackery absolutely sting. Because we were we're very conscious of the fact that Jez is English, I'm American, and we're writing in Ireland for the Irish, for Irish actors. And we were incredibly conscious all the way through to kind of check ourselves. And, you know, we had half the writer's room was Irish. The entire crew was Irish. Most of the cast, with the exception of Robin and Will, were all Irish. And we sort of set up a situation where, you know, as we were shooting and as the rewrites would come in and people would talk about the work we were going to do that day, that anybody could say anything about the Paddy Wackery-ishness of it. And so we were really conscious of being open and willing to change whenever that issue came up. And from what I understand, at least from a lot of my friends in Ireland who have seen it, and a lot of the crew and a lot of the cast, there isn't a sense of Paddy Wackery in the show, because we were really conscious of avoiding that. So, I'm sorry the reviews felt that way, and I think they're wrong.
Part of the construction of the show is that Dove and Gilbert come into this world with very different perspectives, and Dove plays a very important role in this pilot episode, which is that Gilbert comes in wanting an Irish experience, and we do play on a number of tropes, and when those things happen, he's delighted. And Dove is keeps saying to him, this isn't it. This is an island, and in a more meta sense, we were hoping that she would communicate to the audience, like, this is not what this show is.
Yeah.
And because the show is about what is the line between what is true and what is the story, we slightly needed to play on those tropes broadly in the kind of the first 15, 20 minutes, and then just move straight past it into our own specific world. And yeah. Sorry, I said and, but that was a
But there was a period there.
Yeah.
And it's not just, but it's not just the Irish tropes that we play on. It's also the tropes of the American tourist. It's Emmy, who's the Brit who comes in and puts a foot in her mouth. And also it's tropes of podcasting and journalism. And the whole show is constructed. So, you know, in this part, in the pilot episode, it was a very difficult episode of TV to write, because not only are we setting up this whole deck of cards that we're going to pull apart, we were also trying to communicate how to watch the show, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because nothing that you think is going to happen. You know, you come into the show thinking it's going to be, oh, it's going to be kind of a small town cozy murder mystery. From act two onwards, it starts pulling away in its own direction.
And it really isn't what you think it's going to be. And it's very successful that way. And then finally...
Oh, and sorry, John, can I just make one more point as well? It's like, what was quite funny, you know, 50% of our writers were Irish, and all the, you know, all the crew and the cast. And there were a lot of moments actually where people were saying, oh, we can go harder on this. We can go, you know, we can make more fun of this. And actually Alex and I were like, actually, we're not broadly, that's maybe not for us to do. But, you know, there was a push and pull in the rice room on set about finding exactly the right line to thread through this.
Yeah, sure. And then finally, and either of you can answer this, but obviously one of the things whenever the show is discussed is it is from Higher Ground Productions, which have at their helm the former president of America, Barack Obama, and his wife, Michelle. So I can't help but ask, forgive the tabloid nature of it, but, you know, were they involved in any level? I presume they weren't in Union Hall filming with you, but they've seen it. What's their reaction been?
Yeah, sure. The reaction has been great. I mean, I think they've both really enjoyed it. They're both very proud of the show. President Obama is, you know, as Irish as they come. He is an Irish, or as Irish as they come in America, given his Irish grandparentage. So they've been incredibly supportive the entire way through. Both, you know, Higher Ground is a great company, and I think they've. You know, it's an interesting choice for their first television drama to do this. But they've been great about it. Yeah, very supportive all the way through.
Well, look, it has the backing of the Obamas. So what more do you need? It also has the backing of Irish people because, as I keep saying, it's number one in the charts. And taking over Baby Reindeer is no small feat. So, gentlemen, a pleasure to talk to you. I should leave you back to the day ahead and continued success.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Jez Scharf there, creator of Bodkin, and also Alex Metcalf, the co-showrunner and executive producer of Bodkin. An entertaining chat there with the guys about the success of Bodkin, which, as I was at pains to point out, I don't know why I was at such pains to point it out, but it is at number one in the Netflix charts at the time of speaking to you. Now, something very different is a new documentary in cinemas this week all about the Irish cheerleading team. Stay tuned. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now here's something we haven't covered before on the show, cheerleading. That's right, landing this weekend in cinemas, in select cinemas, but plenty of them, is Irish cheerleading documentary Eat, Sleep, Cheer, Repeat, which had its premiere, its world premiere, at the Dublin International Film Festival in March and received a standing ovation. Now in it, it's a fascinating documentary because it centres on a group of teenagers, and there's all sorts of fascinating characters. We have the team captain, glamour queen Jessica, star athlete, COVID anti-vaxxer Jay Leese, dyslexic, athletic Blonid. We have Ricky, who's one of the many men in the Irish team that are attempting to go to the World Championships, who's somewhat of a lost soul. So we've all these fascinating teenage characters being part of the Irish cheerleading team attempting to get to the World Championships in America. Helming all these people is Hilton, who's their coach, who's trying to get them to the World Championships. This sounds like a sports story, but it is very much a true documentary. It's a coming-of-age story that I found absolutely delightful, I have to say. It was directed by award-winning director Tanya Doyle, and I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Tanya, hi, how are you?
Great, how are you?
Very well. So listen, this might sound a bit pejorative, but my understanding of cheerleading before I watched this, right, is that not a bit old-fashioned, out of date? And, you know, I have children. The thoughts of my daughter, it seemed almost sexist that these pretty young women would be standing on the side of some pitch cheerleading for mostly male athletes. And then I watched a documentary, and that I could not be more wrong. Cheerleading is a sport, a very athletic sport, open to men and women. And according to your movie, is very popular in Ireland.
Yeah, there are over 3,000 cheerleaders in Ireland.
Wow.
And it is absolutely, what you're talking about initially there is called sideline cheer.
Yeah.
And we don't do that. Okay?
Yeah.
The documentary is about the sport of cheer.
Absolutely. So, but that's what most people think of. I'm assuming when they think of cheerleading is go one, two, three, or whatever they used to say.
I know, there's a bit of chanting also.
Well, there is, true. Yes, that's true. There's plenty of chanting, actually.
But it's about the sport of cheerleading. And like, the reason we started looking at this crazy world, you know, it's pretty intense, is it's looking at sports where women can be feminine and also can be strong.
Yeah.
And so that's how we made our way to the world of cheer. So in the documentary, we're looking at, it's predominantly, like you're saying, it's a story, a coming of age story, but all of our main characters are like a crossroads in their lives.
Yeah.
And it's following them as they have to make all these, navigate their way through it and make complex decisions.
Well, the delightful thing about it is, because as you can clearly see by me, I'm not in my teenage years, but you capture these people at this time in their lives where, you know, a lot of them are in the leaving cert year and stuff like that. And it's just so teenagery, as in the future is wide open, yet they have this passion for cheer. And it's absolutely gorgeous. So you mentioned that there's 3,000 teams. It seems to me you hit the jackpot by focusing on this particular team, because there are so many delightful, occasionally sad, wonderful characters in it. So how did you find this gang? They're based out of Galway.
So we followed the Irish national team.
Right.
So they're from all over the country.
Ah,
so this is the elite cheerleading team in the country, right? So
But they're based out of Galway, are they?
They are. Well, it depends. Every year it changes. It depends on where the coach is. But Hilton Holian was the coach for Team Ireland this year, the year that we followed them. And how we came across them, we were doing research initially before we pitched this documentary idea. And we went to an event in Belfast to see what cheer was like, you know. And we were just, you know, listening to conversations as you're in the space. And we came across Hilton, and he was in a corner giving his cheerleaders a pep talk, basically, you know, a pep talk. And he was saying, guys, listen, you know, we have to do this. And he was helping them out with their uniforms and fixing their hair. And he just went, ladies, the higher your hair is, the closer you are to God. And everybody just turned and thought, who is this man? And he for us was the way into the world. So once we met Hilton, and we went back to Galway, he's from Galway, and his gym, he has a gym that runs all year. It's Stuntworks Elite is the name of the gym. And we went in there and we hung out there for a couple of weeks and met some great characters. And that's how the story kind of started to build.
Great characters. And of course, I did know they were the national team. So that's obviously how they all were together. That was silly. So you didn't just randomly find these great teenagers. They are part of the Irish national team. But Hilton, like, we can get to the girls and the guys. But Hilton, you know, he's at times he was annoying me because he was. And I say that with love and respect. Maybe love is overstating it, but they're like his children, and he's cheesed off with them at times, but he is living and breathing every moment there on the mat, right?
Absolutely. For me, Hilton was willing them on. I almost think on occasion he wanted it more than they wanted it, because they didn't know what potential they had. So his role, it is a bit complicated. Like, he is like a parental figure, and he's also a supporter, and he encourages them and he nurtures them, but he also has to make sure that they get the job done. So that's his role, changes throughout his experience, his life, you know.
Well, for people who want to get a flavour of what I'm saying, here's Hilton in action.
5, 7, 1, 3, 4, 5, 7. We're in limbo, you guys, because we're not all on the same page. I think that we've maybe just misplaced our motivation. We need to find that again. World is going to happen. We need to believe that it's going to happen. And it's an absolute honor that you guys get to represent your country. So I guess let's be super motivated. Let's really attack it from January.
Hilton Holian there in the wonderful documentary Eat, Sleep, Cheer, Repeat, which I'm talking to its director, Tanya Doyle, about, which is in cinemas, select cinemas, but quite a lot of select cinemas, it has to be said, from this Friday, the 17th of May. Now, there are lovely characters in it, but I don't want to give a spoiler, but the attempt is to go to the World Championships in Florida, and it's not a spoiler to say they go, okay? Because that's, you have to have a journey in a documentary, as you know, right? But along that way, there's too many girls to mention, and guys indeed, but I really want to mention Jaylise. She's brilliant. She doesn't want to take a vaccine and stuff like that. You were following these people for 5 years, right? You must have been like in her story, because as if you were, I was going, and I don't want to get into a vaccine debate, but I was saying, take the vaccine. That way you can go to Florida. Like, as you making this, were you very invested in all this at moments like that? You must have been.
We were so privileged to be able to be with them for so long, you know, like initially for us.
It was 5 years.
5 years, yeah, 5 years. So the plan wasn't to spend 5 years following
no, I can imagine.
Cheerleading team, but because of COVID, you know, it put a lot of roadblocks in the way. And for us, though, it was beneficial because we really got to develop genuine, authentic relationships with people. So we were heavily invested in
it. We wanted
everybody to, you know, to achieve what they wanted to achieve. But for us, with Jaylise, it's one of the key tenets of the film. And it's that, like, you get to a point in your life where you have to make choices, you have to make decisions. And for her, this is the crossroad that I was just talking about. This is the moment where she has to decide. And she makes the decision she makes.
Indeed she does. And talking about being invested, when you go to the World Championships, which I assume you did, you yourself, because sometimes people send other people, but it's a small crew, so I assume you were there. Like we definitely won't get into this, but in terms of what happens, like, you're saying you were invested. My God, that must have been, I don't know what the word is, but you must have been very invested when you were in Florida.
I tell you, it was a gift from the gods, is how I describe it. It was amazing what happened. And exactly. It was a tiny crew, right? So there's myself, there's a producer, Daniel Hegarty. Eleanor Bowman was our cinematographer. Colm O'Mara, sound recordist. That was it, right? And these guys are just full of energy and they're always on the move. And when I say we were just running to keep up with them, that's what we spent. We were there for about 2 weeks and we were just running to keep up with them. And I tell you, it paid off. It really did pay off.
It certainly did. And look, people should go and watch it because, you know, there is a journey in any movie, any sports documentary. There is a great moments at the end of this documentary, it has to be said. You also have the guys and girls, you have them going out and getting ready for nights out. Was that just you wanted to show people these are just kids on the verge of something?
These lads were doing what they were doing and we were observing, we were following, you know, and they were just letting us follow them. Like, we got so many beautiful moments where they're, like, I would call them intimate moments where we're just watching and whatever they were doing is what they were doing. And we went out on a couple of nights with them, but some of them were crazy, so we didn't put it all in, like, you know, they're just living their lives, you know, they're all in school or in work, they cheer and then they spend all their time together, and those moments of them going out, you know, that was what they were.
And this, I presume you finished in 2022, you wrapped, did you?
We finished shooting in 22, yeah.
So I'm assuming all these protagonists, from Dean to Ricky and Jaylise, they've now seen it.
Oh, they have, yeah.
And I are they pleased watching themselves back?
I tell you, that was a terrifying moment. We screened it to the guys before everything else, you know, to make sure everybody was happy with how they were represented. And they were laughing, they were whooping at the screen, they were crying. You know, I think everybody is happy. Everyone is happy. But it was just, that was terrifying, because if they weren't happy, you know, like, when you're making something like this, we get to make it and then walk away, but this is their lives on screen, you know, so you just have to be very conscious of how they're represented. And once they're happy, we're happy. So everyone's delighted with themselves.
Well, they were brilliantly represented. You can see them and you can see them cheer. And in case you're curious about cheerleading, by God, it was a revelation. But it's so much more than that. It is a classic Irish sports documentary, and we don't have that many of them. So hopefully this will start a new pantheon. Eat, Sleep, Cheer, Repeat is in cinemas from this Friday, the 17th of May. And I've been talking to director Tanya Doyle. Tanya, thanks a million for coming into studio.
Thanks.
Tanya Doyle there talking to me about her great new documentary, Eat, Sleep, Cheer, Repeat, all about the Irish cheerleading team. Great documentary. And that's in cinemas from this Friday, as I said, the 17th of May. That is it for this week. I'm off to Bruce Springsteen tomorrow. I shall report on that. And obviously a lot more TV and movies next week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, or indeed wherever you get your podcast, every Friday at 5 p.m. and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.